Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
Baptism every service this weekend. That's awesome. Good way to start the new year off. Hopefully we have a few more here in a bit. Now, real quick, before I get down to business with my sermon today, I have a quick announcement for you about announcements. So just bear with me. So our hope and aspiration for every person who calls Northeast their church home is that you would be in the sort of relationship with Jesus where you're just constantly following him. Like you're constantly taking your next step and then your next step and your next step and your next best step after that. And in fact, we feel a certain sense of responsibility as your church family to help provide for you opportunities where you can grow. But if you look around our room, it's a very diverse room. It's racially diverse, gender diversity, cultural diversity. It's like in terms of your maturity with Jesus, we have new believers, old believers, spiritual seekers. It's really amazing. So the next best step for you is probably different than him, is probably different than her, is probably different than him. So we have lots of different ways for you to grow and get involved, but sometimes it's hard getting to you the exact way that you need to grow and get involved. So we've decided to try to improve our communication this year by doing a couple things. One, by me telling you exactly where we're going to communicate to you from the get-go. All right, so one, you guys need to know that the very best way to get any sort of communication about what's going on at this church and how to grow and take your next best steps is our Northeast app and our website. And they're basically both the same thing. Like we're constantly monitoring. The app is just the app version of the website. The website's just the website version of the app. Last year, we had, 4,100, 4,200 downloads of our app. We have somewhere around 8,700 people who have their app on the phone. So we monitor the app close and we try to keep it up to date. Same thing with the website. So if you're ever interested in what's going on here, jump on the website, jump on the app, get there. In fact, go ahead and pull your smartphone out right now and download the app during the service. I'm totally cool with it. I won't judge you. Your neighbors might judge you. I won't judge you. Okay, I've got the Bible app open, I promise. You know, I get it, right? I don't want to judge you. Just download it real quick. Now, also we email. So if you're not like kind of on our email registry, you need to get on our email register because we email every couple weeks in order to keep important stuff in front of you. It's not spam, I promise. It's important stuff. And then we're on social media as well. Some of you are on social media right now. Okay, take a selfie, tag northeast.church. But we're on every social media channel of Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, so you should follow us there. And we're constantly pushing out information. And again, the reason why we do this isn't just to create more noise, but we want to give you the content that you really, really want. Now, here's the second way we'll do it. As you'll notice, on the app and on the website, we've created a new tile. It's called the What's Next tile, or on the app, it's necchurch.org/whatnext. And throughout the year, we're just going to try this out. If you ever want to know what's next at our church or what's next for you, you go to the What's Next tab, and hopefully it'll simplify it for you. Got it? Want to help you grow this year, so got it? Good, great. Any questions? No? All right. Let's get down to business. Today, I am in part two of a sermon series that we launched last week called Significant. And, excuse me, here's the goal of this series. My goal in this series is to prove to you that our culture's equation for a life of significance, a life of meaning, a life of happiness is ultimately broken. In fact, last week we said it like this. We said the American dream is really the American demise. Okay, and this is the American dream, y'all. Let's just be honest for a second. If we were honest about what we really wanted in life, okay, if we took audit of where we actually spend our time, where we actually spend our money, where our thoughts and our hopes and our aspirations and our dreams drift towards, then we would have to be honest that this right here is the dream for most Americans. But what I have found is that this dream right here is writing checks that it simply cannot cash, and it's turning us into the sort of people that are just disillusioned, discontent, and losing our very souls. I mean, okay, notice, in our culture today, we have more stuff. We have more luxuries. We have more tech. We have more access than literally ever before in the history of the world. But are we happier? Are we? That'd be a really hard case to make. Because when you look at the journals and the media and the art of our culture, when you look at the mental health epidemic that's wreaking havoc on our culture today, it would be hard to make the case that we're happy. In our culture today, we have more freedom to do literally whatever we want, more autonomy and ability to express ourselves and to just do us with our lives, with our bodies, with our careers, with our families than ever. But has that created this sort of peaceful utopia, a tolerant society where we all just get along? Or is there a spirit of divisiveness and this undercurrent of hate that's ripping all the tribes apart? Luxuries are more luxurious. Food tastes better. Sex is more accessible. The world's been flattened and globalized. Life expectancies are longer. But have we arrived? See, when I look around, I don't know. I just don't think so. I cheer on the leaders of our country and of our world for the progress that they've made. But what I found is when you put your faith, hope, and trust in all this progress, you just end up disillusioned and discontent. Our culture's writing checks it can't cash. And have you noticed it? If you're still living here, I'm telling you, you're probably saying to yourself, there has to be something more than just this. Now, in my time doing ministry here in Louisville, I've gotten the opportunity to have hundreds of conversations with people about their inner life, their spiritual life. And what I found is that people fall in really one of three categories when it comes to the American dream. They're either disappointed, in denial, or totally defeated by it. So first, the disappointed people at the top there, these are like the top 10%. These are the high achievers in the room. You are the people who like set goals for your life and you've achieved those goals. Some of you have surpassed those goals. The rest of us look at you and we're like, wow, you are living the dream. You've accomplished the list, right? But if we were to get behind the scenes with you, then what you'd probably tell us is, well, yeah, I guess being successful and wealthier is better than not being, but I don't know, I've summited the mountain and it's not quite as awesome as I thought it would be. I'm living the dream and it's just not as dreamy as I thought it would be. It's kind of disappointing, actually. I wonder if there's something more. The next category of people are those in denial. Oftentimes, this can be the younger generation. Because, like, you just haven't lived life enough yet. So we think to ourselves, if I would just grind a little bit harder, if I just stay in the industry for 5 more years and get these 2 promotions, if I would just add a 0 to my paycheck, if I would just add this missing piece to my life, whatever it is, like a soulmate or a house or you know, live in that cool city over there, then, and only then, but then I will experience the significance and joy I'm looking for. But what happens is if you're one of these denial people, you end up in what I would call the denial addiction cycle. Because what you think to yourself is like, okay, if I just get a little bit more, and then you get more. And you think, but if I just get a little bit more than that, and then you get more. And if I just get a little bit more than that, and as you just see, it just continues to feed this addiction that you have for more. Until eventually you get enough, and you end up disappointed with it all. Or you never get enough, and you end up in category number 3, totally defeated by the American dream. And this is where I believe that most people live their lives. Most of us are normal. Okay, most of us are average, most of us set goals and I don't know, that we don't achieve them. Like we're in our 40s, we're in our 50s, and we didn't become an astronaut like we promised our second grade class we would. And so there can be this just sort of crushing sense of worthlessness on our lives. Do I really measure up? Am I really significant? Now look, I don't know what category you find yourself in today. But here's what I would say to you. If you're sitting in that chair saying there has to be something more, do you know what Jesus says? He says, there is. There is. In fact, Jesus says, let me speak very frankly with you, okay? The problem for most of you guys is you're trying to become the person God created you to be without God. And that's just simply impossible. So if you want to meet God today, Jesus, allow me to introduce you to me. And if you begin to wrap your life and your heart and your dreams and vision around me, then what you'll find is that I can elevate you out of the mundaneness and the brokenness of your everyday life into a life of true eternal significance. That's the heart of this series. It's the heart of it. So what we're doing each week is we're actually looking at a story from Luke's gospel of how Jesus confronts normal everyday people, calls them out of the mundaneness, brokenness, boredom of their lives into a life of significance and making application to our own lives. If you guys were here last week, we did Luke 5, a few famous Jesus followers, Peter, James, and John. You remember that? This week, we're gonna do a more obscure follower of Jesus. But I think I think his story is actually just honestly more fascinating than Luke 5, and the ending is so good. So here's what I want you to do. Just stand with me right now, please. Stand with me, if you will. Out of respect for God's word, we respect God's word here, and so sometimes I just like to stand when we read it. And we're not going to do a congregational reading today. I'm just going to read this story to you. I'll ask you to read one part with me at the end, but I want you to soak this in because it's really one of those strange yet fascinating stories from Scripture. Luke chapter 8, verse 26. It says, "Then they being Jesus and the disciples, arrived at the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. As Jesus stepped out the boat on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time, this demon guy had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his lungs, 'What have you to do with me, Jesus? Son of the Most High God, I beg you, do not torment me.' For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out the man. For many times, this spirit had seized this man. He was kept under guard, bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and then be driven by the demons back out into the wilds. Jesus then asked him, 'What is your name?' And the unclean spirit said to him, 'Legion.'" I don't know how demons talk. It's like, "Hi, my name is Legion." Maybe it was like a demon chorus, because apparently there were many demons who had entered him. And they begged Jesus not to order them to go back into the abyss. Now there on the hillside, a large herd of pigs was feeding, and the demons begged Jesus to let them enter the pigs. And so he gave them permission to enter the pigs, and the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs. And the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake, and they were drowned to death. And when the swineherd saw what had happened, they ran off and told it in the city and in the country. Then people came out to see what had happened, and when they came to Jesus, they found the man, the demon guy, from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed, thank God, and in his right mind. And they were afraid. Those who had seen it told them how the one who had been possessed by demons had been healed. And then all the people from the surrounding country of the Gerasenes, interesting response here, asked Jesus to leave, for they were seized with great fear. So Jesus got in the boat and he left. And the man from whom the demons had gone begged Jesus that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, and I want you to read this with me, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." So he did. He went away, went home, proclaiming throughout the city how much Jesus had done for him. And this is the word of the Lord. You can be seated. Thank you for standing. This story is so fascinating. You know what I love so much about the ending here? What I love is that this man is sent back home. He's sent to stay. He's sent back into an ordinary life. Go back into your home. Go back into your city. Go back into the ordinariness of everyday life, but go back a new man with a new king. And he does it. Now, before I make application of that for your life personally, which you can already kind of see where I'm going with this, what I would like to do is I'd actually like to work our way back through this scriptural text here, just kind of bullet by bullet, give you a summary of it. Because if you read through it too fast without a little bit of commentary, you'll miss some of the salient details in there that sort of bring meaning to it and bring the story to life. So here's a quick summary, just bullet by bullet of what happened. And let's just walk through it, all right? I want you to catch this. All right, first, notice, Jesus and the disciple gang go to an unclean city. You may miss this, but where they went here was Gentile territory. The town was called the Gerasenes. Many scholars debate where that actually was, but one thing they don't debate is that it was in like the Decapolis area, which was Gentile territory, which would have been a place dripping with ritual impurity for a Jew. Like Jewish people, like Jesus and his disciples would not go to places like this because it would make you unclean. It was toxic. Like Luke, the author, goes out of his way to show you just how toxic the area is by calling out all the uncleanness. He says there was like a naked guy who'd been in the tombs and there were unclean spirits. There were pigs everywhere, which pigs are like a no-no for Jewish people. So basically this place is like a gas station bathroom, right? It's like, have you ever been on a road trip with your four-year-old son? And your four-year-old son is like, "Hey, Dad, I gotta use the bathroom." You're like, "No, you don't." And he's like, Yes, I do. And you're like, oh, great. And so you pull into the gas station, you got to go in the gas station bathroom, and you're like, you use the dad voice, touch nothing. You know, don't touch the wall. Don't flush the toilet. Don't step on the floor. Don't even wash your hands in the seat. I will wipe you down with wet wipes in the car because it's toxic in here. Now, this is basically what the Gerasenes were for the Jews. Toxic place. And yet, notice, check this out. Yet, Jesus goes there anyways. He goes there anyways. Now, when he gets there, interesting welcome committee. A naked, psychotic, chain-breaking, screaming demon man accosts him. And this had to be like an I told you so moment for the disciples. This had to be like, Jesus, we told you, should have never come here. Okay, like if this is the first impressions director, think about how bad it gets as we move further inland. Let's go. Row. And before they can row off, Jesus steps off the boat. And he begins a conversation with the demons inside this man. Now, you saw the conversation goes. Jesus casts the demons out. They refuse. No, don't torment us. Don't send us in the abyss. We want to go to the pigs. And Jesus has a very interesting question he asks them next. Did you see the question he asked? He asks the demons, this is when the disciples should have known this dude is a glitch. Like, what's going on? Because he says, what's your name? What's your name? And the demons say, Legion. Now, Legion is actually a word that's used to talk about a regiment of soldiers, like 5,000 to 6,000 big. So apparently this guy had been afflicted by, I don't know, thousands of unclean spirits, a legion of them. Very unfortunate circumstances for him. So Jesus steps in and he sends the spirits out into the pigs and the man's humanity is restored. Because that's what evil does to you, and that's what Jesus does to you. Evil dehumanizes you. Jesus rehumanizes you. Sometimes it is a spontaneous, like, shot right through you in a moment. Usually more often than not, he rehumanizes you through the sanctification process. Slowly but surely, progressively over time as you follow him. But luckily for this demon man, it's just like, you know, boom, Sasquatch to Mr. Rogers in a second. Just zaps it out of him. And there's an amazing healing that happens. Now, the word spreads, the locals freak out, and I just think it's interesting, they immediately tell Jesus to leave. Like if I was him, I'd be like, I've got a few more people for you to fix, okay? And like, come on inside. But they ask him to leave. And this is where the story gets good. The man begs to leave with Jesus. He begs. And wouldn't you? Like Jesus had just reoriented this dude at a molecular level, reoriented him mentally, physically, spiritually, socially. Wouldn't you want to go? Plus, wouldn't you want to get out of that town? This guy would always have a reputation as demon guy in that town. Doesn't matter how rehumanized he is, he would always be known walking down Main Street as the guy everyone's seen naked. Think about it. I wouldn't want that, my reputation in my town, but that's his reputation. So no wonder he's ready to become one of the 13th disciples, you know, and make a move. But Jesus has different plans for him. Jesus says, yeah, you're going to follow me. Yeah, I'm going to send you. But you're not going to follow me back to Galilee. No, I'm going to send you home. Into your home, into your workplace, into your city. I'm sending you to stay. And then Jesus leaves. He leaves. Apparently that was the only thing that was on Jesus' to-do list in the Gerasenes, was to travel on a boat to unclean territory to heal the village idiot so he could be light and darkness. Love that about Jesus. Because he leaves. And then the man goes. And he declares to Jesus, it seems like he has some success from the way that it's written there in the text. He declares to Jesus, or declares to his city, what Jesus has done for him. What an epic ending. He sent to stay. And allow me to make practical application for your life today. I think that the exact same thing is true for the American Christian, just like you and just like me today. We are sent to stay. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but in the United States of America, we live on one of the most opportunistic, mission fields. It's a good way to say it. Mission fields on the face of the planet Earth today. This is a mission field, if you will. Did you know that the modern West is really the only place the church is declining in the world today? It's exploding in the global South. It's exploding out in the Middle East and the farther East. Like it's but in Europe, in America, in Canada, it's in decline fast. Now, recent studies have shown that still about 7 out of 10 Americans call themselves a Christian, but only 2 out of 10 actually practice basic Christianity. 2 out of 10. Now, by basic Christianity, this is what I mean. Just to be clear. They gather weekly with their church family. They pray and meditate daily on scriptures. Pretty basic, right? They share their faith with others, give generously, live in community, hold one another accountable, be kind to others. They try and love everyone, and they eat a lot with people. This is pretty basic stuff, right? It's what Christians have been doing for like 2,000 years now. And yet only 2 out of 10 people do it. So, okay, you know what that means? For every 2 Christians who live like that, there are 5 Christians who don't, sullying the 2's reputation. And then there are 3 people who could care less about it. Walking the streets of our city, state, and country every day. Kind of a pessimistic spin on America, huh? Now, here's what you should know about me. I'm not pessimistic, though. I'm a very optimistic person. I am filled with hope because of what Jesus has done in my life. If you only knew, you would have hope in Jesus. So, to the 2 out of 10 in the room, let me give you a positive spin on this 2 out of 10 statistic. Basic Christians. Look up here now. What a time to be alive. Perhaps, just perhaps, we have been sent here for such a time as this. Look, if only 2 out of 10 of us actually care to live out our Christianity, then that means that 5 out of 10, 50% of the people that you rub shoulders with every day are sympathetic to Jesus, but just lukewarm. And all they need to be is heated up in order to be sent on mission for God. And 3 out of 10 people are either de-churched or unchurched, and we get an opportunity to present Jesus' love and truth for them, which is life-changing in all the right ways for the first time. What a time to be alive. We have an amazing opportunity on this mission field. And this is the mindset shift that we 2 out of 10 have to take if we're going to bring God's kingdom to bear. Okay, so let me say it to you like this, all right? Just to be a little bit clearer. Right? In order to find a mission field, you don't have to get on a plane, fly to another continent to a poor black community. You don't. There is no necessary correlation between spiritually poor and being materially poor. There is none. I've met people who are desperately poor in terms of material wealth. I went to the other side of the world, to Uganda. I went to Bolivia, poorest country in South America. And I have met people there who don't have homes, who don't have food, who don't have access to clean water, who are dying of HIV, malaria, fill in the blanks. And they're like spiritual Yodas. I'm like sitting at their feet, like pour into me with the time that you have left. And they're spiritually poor, physically poor, but spiritually rich, right? In the same way, I've met some of the celebrity Christians that you've probably read their books and known, and then you get them behind the stage, and some of them, many of them are legit, but some of them aren't. It's just like, oh. So there's no necessary correlation between the two. The church has been called to alleviate both spiritual and material poverty. That's true. The two aren't necessarily associated with the other. So you don't have to fly to the heart of Africa in order to find a mission field, which is what most of us tend to think. No, for most of us, all you got to do is walk across the street. All you got to do is go to the cubicle next door. For some of you, all you have to do is sit around the dinner table at night, and you can find a mission field. Now, that's why, diagram, please. I believe it's never been more important for us to catch a vision of what it looks like to live a loveable lifestyle. This is not just like a catchy brand, all right, that we put on coffee mugs. It is that. Okay, but it's so much more than that. This is the kingdom of God. This is eternity hanging in the balance right here. This is significance. Shot through your life every day. Every moment can be an eternal moment. If this is your mission. Okay, so if you're like me, you live your life in four spheres: home, workplace, city, and church. Maybe you're a student, you should add school to that as well. So you got five spheres, right? But for me, I live my life in four spheres. And so I wonder, if you're like me, do you have an intentional strategy to take Jesus' love and bring his truth to bear in each one of those spheres of influence? Do you have like a how and a who identified in those areas to bring the kingdom to? If you don't, if any one of these areas you lack an intentionality and strategy, then I would tell you that you may be on mission for Jesus, but not with your whole life. And so it's just time to up the ante and get intentional about it. So I've been talking about this since, I don't know, like August or September of last year, but one of the big challenges of 2020 is that we want everyone in our congregation to develop a Love the Ville playbook, if you will. In fact, I'm gonna give you playbooks here in a couple weeks. We want everybody to have a playbook. And by that I mean, I just want you to have this diagram and like a little journal on your phone or however you wanna do it. And on a weekly basis, I want you to just check yourself, get some accountability in your life, a friend, your wife, your whatever, you know, small group, and get some accountability and just start checking yourself on a weekly basis. How am I intentionally taking Jesus home, workplace, city, and church? Because this is significant. This is how you shoot every moment through with eternity for Jesus. Now, well, I feel like the diagram makes the mission pretty easy. For most of us, we lack in confidence when it comes to bringing Jesus' love to bear. And here's the reason why. I think one of the main reasons why we don't talk more about Jesus is because when we look around in our relational circles, others seem to be doing all right. They're doing all right. They're just fine. This is why I lose my confidence sometimes, because people just, they're fine. I got a lot of non-Christian friends, and they seem to be doing fine with their life. They get good jobs. They're trying to make the world a better place. They're kind. They're doing just fine, so it seems. I got some friends who are in like their late 20s, early 30s, but they act like they're in their late teens, early 20s, and I'm like, they're gonna destroy themselves if they don't straighten up soon. But then you look on their Instagram stories on Friday night, and it's like, ooh! You know, they're having a blast, right? So it seems. Maybe some of you have friends who used to be a part of this church and they just sort of faded out. Maybe they're in your community group and they just sort of faded out and you've never really brought it up with them because you're super busy and there's no crisis. They seem to be doing just fine. Isn't that the case? Isn't that why we just don't ever really bring it up? Because they're fine. Now, here's what I would tell you, though. If you could get behind the veneer that most of us feel the pressure to project, especially in a place like East Louisville, this veneer of like, I'm doing fine and I'm doing better than fine, I'm doing really, really good. If you could get behind that, what you would find is that there are some people who are doing just fine, but nobody ever wants to live a life that's just fine. And then what you would find behind that is that there are many people who, well, they're not fine. Life is hard. Life's hard, guys. You haven't figured that out yet? You will. Life's hard. You know, for some people, life's straight up brutal. For a few people in this room and in your life, they have a hard time getting out of bed in the morning. And you would never know because mask on, I'm fine. So my encouragement to you would be to have the confidence to bring Jesus' truth and bring Jesus' love to bear on their lives. Because it's just love, right? Love never hurt nobody. It's just love. So bring it to bear. There are people right now drowning in discontentment, drowning in disappointment, drowning in depression, drowning in loneliness, drowning in addiction, drowning in whatever sin struggle it is right now, and they're just waiting for someone to extend a helping hand and pull them out. They're not just fine, even though if you were to ask them, hey, how you doing? They'd say, I'm fine. So Bob Cherry, our founding pastor, and I lead a small group of men who are like elite leaders in our church. And it's always interesting. These are like spiritually, you know, connected guys with God. And every time Bob starts off the meetings, he'll say to these guys, hey, how you doing? And everybody will be like, fine, I'm doing fine, I'm fine, fine, I'm great, I'm better than great, fine. And then Bob will do this, he'll go, okay, how are you really doing? And before you know it, it's like, it's like waterworks. And these guys are supposed to have it together. They're the ones you look at and you're like, oh, look at them. They're fine, right? They're not fine. So we got to have this confidence. Now check this out. Here's what you'll find though. If you do bring Jesus' love to bear in our culture, you will experience some level of resistance. In fact, this is what Jesus calls this demon guy to do. Jesus actually calls this demon guy to stay in a place of resistance. Did you see this? If you go back and read the passage, Jesus heals the guy, and immediately everybody comes out and tells Jesus to leave because they're terrified. I don't know what they were afraid of. Maybe they were afraid because Jesus like decimates the pig farming industry in their community. Maybe they're afraid because he's clearly like a magician or a wizard or of some sort, and they don't like that sort of power. But they sort of send Jesus off, right? And if you're like me, sometimes you can feel like religion or any belief at all in the transcendent in our culture has just been sort of sent out of the public square. Oh, that's nice. You're religious. Just keep that in the confines of your worship services in your private home. Now, this is review for some of you, but here are pretty much the three main reasons why I believe like Jesus kind of sent off in our culture. This is what we're labeled as in America. We're inauthentic, intolerant, and hypocritical. And so I don't want any of that in my life. So just keep that in your life. We're called inauthentic because Christianity oppresses your authenticity. In a culture, I mean, this is kind of true. In a culture that says the authentic version of you is just doing you, following your heart, doing what you feel. This is what's being sown into the minds of our young people, by the way. It's follow your heart, do what you feel. And in a culture that says that, yeah, there's gonna be a rub with Christianity. Let me be very clear what Jesus says, okay? Jesus doesn't say do you, he says deny you. This is what Jesus says. Jesus says, I'm king. And so I exercise universal authority over every aspect of your life. This is what Jesus says. Jesus says, if you enslave yourself to me, then I'll set you free. And our culture says, no. If you break the chains of any sort of slavery or any sort of external authority, any sort of transcendent force at all, then you'll set yourself free. And no wonder there's a rub, right? No wonder it doesn't surprise me. There's a rub. We live a counterculture, Christians. We're also called intolerant, because Christianity is intolerant of others, which actually is not true. Now, Christianity is what I would call exclusivistic. Just like every other major world religion, and just like atheism, we believe we have the corner of the market on truth, just like atheists do. We believe Jesus is the way, the truth, and life. It's pretty simple. But here's the, we're not intolerant. We're intolerant. In fact, I would suggest to you that Christianity is really the only major world religion that gives its followers the spiritual resources to be quite tolerant of everyone. Our religion tells us that every human being that you look at the very least, is created in the image of God, which means they have eternal dignity and eternal worth, and they're died for by Jesus, which means that they have the unconditional love of Jesus no matter how they respond to him. That's amazing. That equips you to love even your enemies. That's not intolerant. Last, certainly not least, we're called hypocritical, and that's because a lot of the Christian leaders in in the mainstream and on the front pages of our society are kind of hypocritical sometimes. I shouldn't say all of them, not all of them, but some of them. It seems like every day there's like a new story kind of coming out of a power play, a sex scandal, greed, whatever it is. But let me be clear. If you get in a Christian community, what you'll find is that there are far more faithful people than there are unfaithful people, but those stories aren't nearly as salacious as the unfaithful stories. So the unfaithful stories get plugged into the front page of the newspaper and Christians get labeled accordingly. And this is what you end up hearing. Inauthentic, intolerant, hypocritical. And when you're hearing that over and over and over by all of our cultural mediums, it just steals your confidence. In fact, it might even make you begin to doubt whether or not your religious perspective is actually potent enough to change a human life. So if that's you today and you have some doubt or you're losing confidence, I just want to remind you, Jesus works. He does, he works. Just look at your own life. Okay, and I don't want to remind you of this. What our culture is selling, it doesn't work. It may be sweet tasting at first, but the sweetness is temporary, right? It doesn't work. Just look at your own life. Or maybe I could say it to you like this. The rub between Christianity and our culture is the difference between a religion that's built on radical, cross-shaped selflessness versus a worldview, a culture that's built on radical individualism. That's our culture, radical individualism. And while radical individualism may sound really, really cool on the surface, it has some definitive pitfalls that we've seen in our culture. For example, radical individualism has a heavy emphasis on personal freedom, but that's at the expense of real, true belonging. See, I'm all for freedom. I want people to have the free will and moral agency to be able to make their own decisions about God. I do. Christianity should never be coercive because Jesus doesn't coerce you into his love. But what I have found is that when the constant input is more freedom, that's what will fix you. More freedom, break those chains. You know, don't look outside at any external authority. Look within, follow your heart. More freedom, more freedom, more freedom. What it does is it undermines your ability to cultivate any sort of belonging. Because you know what belonging and community requires? Think of a marriage. This is a perfect example of it. For a marriage to work, it involves you sacrificing some individual freedoms in order to experience the greater freedom of community and belonging. But in a society built on personal freedom, it undercuts and short circuits that belonging. This is why commitment does not happen in our culture anymore. Commitment to a city, commitment to a job, commitment to a church, commitment to a friend group or a marriage just sort of falls apart. This is why we're the most connected generation ever and the loneliest generation ever at the same time. Radical individualism also has a heavy emphasis on personal achievement. But that's at the expense of contentment. Have you noticed this? By definition, an individualistic culture says that an individual's worth is based on their individual achievement. Your worth is based on what you achieve. So no wonder so many of us feel so defeated all the time. We have this burden of achievement on us. No wonder our kids are like, oh, get away, mom and dad, because we put that burden on them. This is why babies are like listening to Mozart in utero and the travel ball scene is cutthroat. If you are an umpire in Little League travel ball, Lord bless and keep you. I'm praying for you, right? Because it's cutthroat out there. Because this is where helicopter parents come from, lawnmower parents come from, because we get our sense of personal achievement based on our kids, and so we push that burden on them. This is why students come out of college with an enormous amount of student debt. Because I got to get a degree in that particular industry from that particular school so I can be competitive for that job. Because if I don't get that job, life is over. This is why workaholism is destroying people and just burning them down. Because I got to work, climb, and get to that place of power, that place of significance, or that place of wealth in order to prove my worth to the world. Your worth depends on it. And so also, this is why people are perpetually discontent, mentally ill, and self-medicating, like every day. Because personal achievement comes at the expense of contentment often. Radical individualism also has a heavy emphasis on personal image rather than vulnerability. So this is why you never know if you're getting like a legit version of somebody else. This is why political correctness is such a thing. This is why one side of the aisle fears political correctness and the other side of the aisle is just always angry with it. This is why virtue signaling and finding your cause. Even though I just heard of this cause yesterday on Twitter and I watched like a 2-minute video of this talk show host talking about it. Now I'm an expert on it, but I got to find my cause with my thin belief and stand for it. This is why on social media, people post their highlight reels rather than their actual real everyday lives. This is why people are like brands now. You ever notice that? Like corporations aren't brands, you're a brand. Sometimes me and my friends will joke with each other, oh, that was so off-brand for you. Like, because this is how it is, right? So, don't you see it? Belonging, contentment, vulnerability, these are things that are sacrificed at the altar of radical individualism. It's not working. So George Orwell, George Orwell, 1984. George Orwell, not a Christian, wrote this once. And this is a little bit graphic, but I think these are graphic times. So why don't you stay with me here. Orwell wrote, I thought of a rather cruel trick I once played on a wasp. He was sucking jam on my plate and I cut him in half. He paid no attention, merely went on with his meal, while a tiny stream of jam trickled out of his severed esophagus. Only when he tried to fly away did he grasp the dreadful thing that had happened to him. It is the same with the modern man. The thing that has been cut away is his very soul. Now look, people feel this. And commenting on this, one of my favorite preachers taught this. He said, we've basically said in a secular society that you don't need God. You can be whoever you want to be, do whatever you want to do without any consequences at all. And while we are filling our lives with the sweetness that our culture offers, what we don't realize is that we've severed our bodies from our very souls. And people feel this. So let me bring this thing to a point here. Okay, what's my point? My point is this. Our culture's issues with Christianity, it's inauthentic, it's intolerant, it's hypocritical. They are a caricature of Christians and humanity at our worst, not a vision of Jesus at his best. And when you catch a vision of Jesus at his best, not only does it transform your heart, but it can shape the trajectory of your life. Jesus works. In the face of the inefficacy of everything else, Jesus works. And the real question we have to deal with, 2 out of 10, is this. How do we bring Jesus' love and truth to bear on a world that so clearly, desperately is in need of it? How? Well, let's keep it simple. Luke chapter 8, Jesus tells demon guy the way. Jesus says, return home and declare how much God has done for you. Just take your story, right? And declare it. And so he went home, proclaiming throughout his city how much Jesus had done for him. Maybe it's as simple as that. Maybe it's as simple as your story. Now, for some of you who are wondering, what's my story? I took a little time this week to write down just a few stories of folks from our church, and maybe these will help, I don't know, inspire, awaken something inside of you. Yeah, I made huge, huge mistakes in college, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I had a drinking problem, a drug problem, a pornography problem, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I know, I cheated on my wife, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I did a hard time in prison for the mistakes I made, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I was lonely once too, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I lost one of my children when they were way too young, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I failed as a parent, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I tried to take my own life, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I'm single and I wish I could find love, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I was a legalistic Christian who cast judgment on everyone because they didn't measure up, but inside I knew I couldn't measure up. And now look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, I was hurt by the church, but look at what Jesus has now done for me. Yeah, I was dealing with all sorts of disappointment and discontentment, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, my career didn't have the success I hoped for, but look at what Jesus has done for me. Yeah, my career had all the success that I could ever have hoped for, but now look at what Jesus has done for me. Or how about this one? Yeah, I spent my whole life pursuing all the things that could not fill my soul. But now look at what Jesus has done for me. Now look, that's my story. Some of you are smiling and head nodding because that's your story too. And my prayer all this week is that in this room, in this moment, for some of you, Jesus would do the same for you today and awaken inside of you his power. He could do so much for you. Do so much for you. So here's what I want to do right now. I actually want to enter into a time of communion with the last 6 minutes we got in this service. I'm going to ask our servers come forward. Servers come forward and start passing communion. And as I do, take a little piece of bread, a cup of juice, hold on to it. Lindsay's going to come and sing. I'm going to ask some probing questions to help us think through what Jesus has done for us. Because that's what this time is about, right? It's remembering exactly what he's done for us. So whatever it takes for you to kind of push the distractions of the world to aside for a moment, just do that. I don't know, turn your phone off, close your eyes. Do what you got to do. And let's remember what Jesus has done for us. Now, here's the first question I would ask you to consider, all right? What has Jesus done for you? It's the point of communion. What has he done for you? What life has he brought you out of? What light has he shined on your darkness? What oppression has he broken? Chain has he broken in your life? What has he forgiven again, again, and again, and again? What part of your story has he chosen to use for his glory? What has he done for you? Take a moment and just go before him with that.
You are waymaker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness. My God, that is who you are. You are waymaker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness, my God, that is who you are.
What way has he made? What miracle has he worked? What promise has he kept? What light has he shined? How has he shown the power of God in your life? He deserves a moment of praise and thanks for that. So just bring that into mind right now and lift it up to him. Thank him for that.
You are way maker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness, my God, that is who you are. You are way maker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness, my God, that is who you are.
So here's my next question. You have been saved to be sent, y'all. We have a mission. So, where's Jesus sending you? Where? If it helps, use the Love the Lifestyle diagram. Home, workplace, city, church. Like, do you sense him nudging you in a certain direction? Like, where is he sending you here at the beginning of the new year? Or maybe a better question would be, who is he sending you to in each one of these arenas? Like, who is he sending you to in this church? This isn't just like a drive-through experience. This is a spiritual family. So who's he sending you to in this city? Is there a least of these demographic that's been invisible or forgotten for far too long? Who's he sending you to at your very home? Who's he sending you to in your workplace? Where's Jesus sending you?
You are here, touching every heart. I worship you.
This is for a very specific group in the room, the minority in the room, but the majority won't mind me asking this question for you. This may be the most important question you've ever answered. Has Jesus saved you? Have you asked Jesus to save you? You gotta be saved before you're sent for Jesus. And I know that's why some of you have sort of shuffled into this room here in this season of the year. This is what people do in December, January. It's something about this time of year that gives you the sense that you need a spiritual spark in your life. Well, I'm glad you're here for this moment. And I believe that this story encourages you, answered this question. You know what I love about this story? Jesus finds this man. You don't have to find Jesus. He comes and finds you. He comes to Gentile territory. He kicks down the gas station bathroom door of your life, walks into your disappointment, walks into your depression, walks into your addiction, walks into your struggle, walks into your relational loneliness, walks into whatever depravity you feel like you're drowning in, and he comes and finds you, and then he fights for you. He fights the battle for this man. The man didn't have to deal with the demons. Jesus does, and he sends him off by his authority in a moment, restores him. In fact, there is one thing that this demon guy does. Did you catch it in the story? One thing. Luke 8:27. It says, as Jesus stepped on the land, the man of the city who had demons met him. He met him. I wonder, have you ever met him? Have you ever met him? Today, meet him. I don't care if you're stinking like pigs, naked, homeless, unclean spirits. Like, I don't care if you're mentally destroyed, physically devastated, spiritually dark. Just meet him. He wants you. He does.
Even when I don't see it, you're working. Even when I don't feel it, you're working. You never stop, you never stop working. You never stop, you never stop working. Even when I don't see it, you're working. Even when I don't feel it, you're working. never stop, you never stop working. You never stop, you never stop working.
So there just has to come a moment in time where you just choose to meet him, right? The rest of your life you spend following him, but there has to be a moment where you choose to meet him. So if that is today for you, in solidarity with your spiritual family here at this church who loves you, what I want you to do right now is I want you to take the bread, drink the juice. That represents exactly what Jesus has done for you. And then would you do me a favor, everybody stand together. And one more time, we're gonna sing the chorus of this song. For the insiders here at Northeast, I would just ask you, close your eyes, open your hands, receive this, lift this to God. But for those of you today who are like, I gotta meet him, this is my moment. You can feel God's presence inside of you just provoking you. I'm gonna call you to make this your moment. All right, as the rest of the church sings, make your way out of the aisle. And through those doors right there in the back, I want you to walk out those doors. To the left is our little fireside room where our pastors will be there to meet you, pray with you, help you figure out what's next. But make today the day. You gotta make a day. Someday's gotta be the day, right? Why not today? Some of you are like, I'm kind of embarrassed. Okay, there's lots of people in here. Here's the deal. I promise you these people are cheering for you, okay? Now, sometimes, sometimes in church, like, people are like this and like, can I clap? Can I say, okay. Inside, most of the people in our church are like, yeah, yeah. In fact, this is what I tell you. You could, like, grab somebody by the arm, all right, that you don't know if you're here alone, and they will walk with you out there. That's how eager they are for you to have this moment, for you to take this bold step. So as the rest of us sing, I'm gonna ask you to move, and together, let's just proclaim to the world what Jesus has done for us.
Well, hey, thank you so much for being here in our online campus today. Like I said, we really are so glad that you were here. If something in this sermon today really hit you hard and you feel like you would like to talk about it, we would love to continue this conversation either in the chat or you can send me an email directly and we can talk. I can't wait to get those conversations started. For now, know that we love you. And as a person who is part of our online campus here at Northeast, we are praying for you every single day. And we really mean that. For now, go out and love the Ville, no matter where you are. Have a great week.